Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 14th of February, these are our main stories. The earthquake death toll passes 37,000 as the Turkish rescue effort starts to wind down. Also,
the White House press secretary, it was slightly bizarre and amusing, said that we can definitely rule out it's not aliens, it's not extraterrestrials.
Some clarity about those mysterious objects that have been shot down over North American skies in recent days, and shocking revelations about widespread sexual abuse within the Roman Catholic Church in Portugal. Also in this podcast, a powerful cyclone triggers a state of emergency in New Zealand, and the Czech star who's become the first international player in men's football to come out as gay. A week after the devastating earthquakes in Turkey and Syria, the number of dead has now passed 37,000, and there are fears the number could even double. There are still some miraculous stories of survival, but those rescues are becoming rarer, and now the focus is more on caring for the millions who've survived. Jamie Le Sœur is the head of emergency operations at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in the Turkish city of Gaziantep.
What do people need for their basic livelihoods? It's food, water, shelter, and health. This is the priority. And so that's where our operational focus is right now. We've sort of transitioned out of the search and rescue phase. The humanitarian phase is in full swing now. And getting those four needs addressed quite comprehensively is really where the thrust of the operation is at the moment.
Jamie Le Sœur. Well, also in Gaziantep is our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who told me more about the winding down of the search and rescue effort.
Yes, a week on, just by the laws of science and nature, it's recognized that it is very, very difficult for people to survive. Even the stories of today, a 10-year-old pulled from the rubble, a 4-year-old child in the early hours of this morning, surviving without water to drink, much air to breathe, in freezing temperatures. But this decision about when to call off the rescue effort is regarded as one of the most painful which has to be made in operations like this, because the rescue teams, we've seen them working around the clock, determined to search for every single sign of life. The relatives who gather around these mounds of rubble, still believing in their hearts that their loved ones are still there somewhere alive, if only they dig deeper or search longer. But it is a time, of course, of limited resources and diminishing hope. And so we saw today, for example, at the worst affected area of Gaziantep on a street which has mounds of rubble, that it was now a cleanup operation. And the areas where buildings collapse like a deck of cards, they're now almost cleaned up.
And it is just an awful thought, isn't it, Lise, that there will be people who are alive, who are underground, just no one knows where they are or where, how to get them out.
Countless people have been entombed by these broken buildings. Whole streets have been turned into vast cemeteries. We saw over the weekend when we visited an area closest to the epicenter, Karamanamaraş, where body bags were being taken out every hour on the hour from different hills of rubble, and yet the relatives waited by the side for the news they didn't want confirmed. And often when a body bag would come out, you'd see one relative and it would be written on their face exactly what the bad news was. And we'd see time and again relatives just collapsing with overwhelming grief, a grief with the weight of gravity pulling them to the ground as they realized that all hope was lost, and now here was the proof that they feared that their loved ones were dead.
And Lise, millions of survivors, what are the challenges for them?
Well, this is it. And this is millions of people, staggering numbers across the border in Syria, more than 5 million said to be homeless. But here, too, people needing shelter in freezing temperatures, hot food to eat, a sense of a future.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. Well, for the many injured survivors, the biggest challenge is to get adequate medical treatment. Several of Turkey's hospitals have been completely destroyed, so specialist teams have been arriving from all over the world in the past week to offer support. Our correspondent Nick Beek has been to an Israeli-run field hospital in Marash.
In the heart of this devastated city, we meet 5-year-old Aras. He was pulled from the rubble after 105 hours. He had hypothermia. His temperature was 28 degrees. Aras's brother, sister and dad were all killed in the earthquake.
İçimiz yandı. Herkesin yandı.
Sitting at his bedside and ruffling his hair, his grandfather Mehmet says he'll now treat Aras like his own son.
İstediğini sorar, sorduğuna cevap verir.
He's an honest boy. He has a strong personality. He's not spoiled. He's sincere. The rescuers and the doctors did so well to save him. And by God's grace, they gave him back to us alive.
Aras's mum survived and is being treated in another hospital. But this is one of so many families torn apart. And for the medics, at the heart of all this, it's been an exhausting and traumatic week. Dr. Mehmet Cehan rushed here from Istanbul to help.
Yeah, it's very bad. Too much of the childs have lost their parents. So I don't know. It's very hard. Yeah, it's too hard for me.
At Turkoğlu, British doctors are setting up a field hospital. The need for emergency care may have passed, but 80,000 people living in the town are lacking many services. Dr. Bryony Pointer is a GP from Chichester.
We are working with the, you know, the Turkish doctors and nurses that are here, set up their own tent and are seeing patients, but they're quite overwhelmed.
Medics from around the world are now in Turkey to help with the physical injuries. But the mental trauma is also profound, both the personal and the national.
Nick Beek. And we have some news just in. The head of the United Nations Humanitarian Affairs has told a Security Council meeting that the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, has agreed to open 2 more border crossings to allow in aid from Turkey. Martin Griffiths, who met President Assad in Damascus, told the council that these borders would remain open for 3 months. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomed the decision and urged Damascus to accelerate visa approvals. First came the shooting down by the US of a large Chinese balloon. Then 3 other UFOs, unidentified flying objects, shot down in Alaska and close to the US-Canadian border. The most recent object is described as an octagonal-shaped structure with strings hanging off it, floating some 6,000 metres over the state of Michigan. Washington says the balloon was used for spying by Beijing, but who owns the other 3 objects and what their purpose is has been a mystery. Well, on Monday, the National Security Advisor, Admiral John Kirby, tried to provide some clarity.
When President Biden came into office, he directed the U.S. intelligence community to do a broad assessment of Chinese intelligence capabilities and to ensure that we were working to detect and to protect against them. For reasons that you will all understand, we cannot publicly go into many details about how we discover and counteract foreign intelligence collection efforts. But we were able to determine that China has a high-altitude balloon program for intelligence collection that's connected to the People's Liberation Army.
Our Washington correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, told me more about what else was said.
they're saying that it's definitely not aliens. So at the start of the press conference, the White House press secretary, it was slightly bizarre and amusing, said that we can definitely rule out it's not aliens, it's not extraterrestrials. But, you know, Alex, America is a country full of conspiracy theorists who don't always believe their government. So I don't know if she did much to quell that speculation. But in all seriousness, as we heard there from Mr. Kirby, so the three objects that were shot down Friday, Saturday and Sunday, the one in Michigan is lying in very deep water. Same with the other objects. So they're in really remote terrain, so very hard to recover. And therefore, they still don't know exactly what they are. But he did want to make a distinction between those objects and the alleged spy balloon operated by China, which was taken down nearly 2 weeks ago. They're still very clear on what that is. The other thing I really want to point out here, which Mr. Kirby emphasised, was that the US military has readjusted its radar system to a frequency where they are now detecting more objects. So he said they're seeing more because they're looking for more.
I'm still fascinated, though, by what these are, because there seems to be a growing consensus that the later ones are not balloons, and yet somehow moving around slowly, self-propelled. What do we know?
The thing Mr. Kirby said was they're still calling them objects, so they're not calling them balloons, so you're right on that, and they are being propelled by the winds. We know that they're much smaller in shape, so the one that was shot down on Friday is car-shaped, the one on Saturday was cylindrical, the one on Sunday was octagonal. So very different to what they shot down on the 4th of February, which the US maintains was definitely a spy balloon. These other three, we just don't know what they are. It could be some time to find out exactly what they're intended for.
Nomi Iqbal in Washington. There were dramatic scenes outside and inside the Israeli parliament in Jerusalem on Monday as the Knesset Constitutional Committee voted to push through the first stage of proposed highly controversial reforms to the judiciary. The plans would make it easier for the government to overrule the Supreme Court, and the executive would also have more powers to appoint judges. Israel has seen some of its biggest demonstrations in years since the plans were announced last month. And Monday was no different, with tens of thousands rallying outside Israel's parliament in Jerusalem. A chorus of demonstrators outside of parliament chanted, "Shame, shame." Addressing protesters, the former Prime Minister Yair Lapid had this message for his government.
They pretend not to hear and pretend not to be afraid, but they hear and they are afraid. We will not shut up. They're trying to turn the state of Israel into a dark dictatorship and shut us up, but they won't be allowed to do that.
Yeah, Lapid. Well, there were rowdy scenes inside Parliament as lawmakers pounded on their desks, while there were chants of fascist and traitor. Some were dragged out by security. Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell has been following Monday's events and sent this report from Jerusalem.
The shout going up from the crowd is democracy. Protesters here amid a sea of blue and white Israeli flags believe that's what's under threat. Inside the parliament building, a committee met to advance legislation that will give the government greater control over appointing judges and weaken the Supreme Court's ability to strike down legislation. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who faces charges of corruption, which he denies, says that the changes will stop judicial overreach. Demonstrators believe it will destroy the independence of the justice system.
You know, they are tearing apart the spirit of this country, and they are threatening the power of the legal systems, and I just cannot stand aside and see it's all happening without protesting against it.
I'm against fascism and dictatorship. They are attacking our judiciary system. There will be no democracy.
Hundreds of firms allowed staff to miss work to join the mass rally. And at the end of the day, as protesters crammed into the Jerusalem railway station singing the national anthem, there was a suggestion that Israeli ministers had heard their message. They said they were contacting opposition leaders to coordinate a meeting with the president, who's been calling for compromise. But with Israel so deeply divided, it remains to be seen whether one can be reached.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. A catalogue of horrific sexual abuse has been uncovered within the Catholic Church in Portugal. After hearing testimony from hundreds of victims, the Independent Commission found nearly 5,000 children who were sexually abused since 1950. Most of the perpetrators were priests. The commission said the abuse was endemic in some places, and its findings were the tip of the iceberg. Alison Roberts told Oliver Conway more about the revelations.
It's shocking, but one could say it's not surprising because the commission, which has been working for a year now, said in October that it had hundreds of victim and witness testimonies that it was working through. In the end, it spoke in great detail to 564 people, most of them victims, some of them witnesses. But they said that in many cases, the testimony given pointed to many other children. We're talking about minors here having been abused. For example, people saying that a priest or another figure in the church abused all the children in the institution, or that they knew of others in their parish church who were being abused. So we've had the whole morning hearing from the words of victim apps. The chair of the commission made a point of repeatedly quoting directly from the testimony given by victims about how they had suffered not only at the time but over their lives, and in many cases also because they saw these officials remain in their positions even in the few cases, relatively few cases, when complaints were submitted to the church.
And what do these findings mean for the Catholic Church in Portugal going forward?
Well, this independent commission was set up by the Portuguese Episcopal Conference itself at the end of 2021, and it promised to give it all freedom to access the archives. In fact, that took a little longer because the Vatican had to send a letter in June last year authorising them to look at every single bit of the archives when there were cases dealt with in the past or not dealt with in the past. So they've done a lot of that, although they admit there's a lot more still to be done. The church itself has welcomed the report, said that they received it with gratitude. And they're also going to be holding an extraordinary assembly of the Episcopal Conference on the 3rd of March to look in detail at this report and to decide what kind of justice they can offer to victims. Now, we know that in other countries that's involved financial compensation. There hasn't been any talk about those kind of details yet. We'll have to see what comes out of that extraordinary assembly.
And briefly, some of the victims may get to meet the Pope.
Yes, indeed. But of course, the vast majority of the victims not only do not want to appear in public in any way, but also want to remain anonymous and indeed didn't even want to meet the commission in person.
Alison Roberts speaking to Oliver Conway. When the Afghan Taliban marched into Kabul 18 months ago, thousands of nationals who'd worked with the Western allies feared for their lives. They included dozens of journalists who'd worked for the BBC. Many were helped to relocate in the UK, but some were left behind. Now, eight of them have successfully sued Britain's Defence Secretary and the Home Secretary after their first applications to relocate to the UK were rejected. Here's our Home and Legal correspondent, Dominic Cassiani.
All eight of the journalists had worked for many years for the BBC in Afghanistan, and during and after the 2021 Taliban takeover, they and their families became the targets of threats. London's High Court was told one of the journalists had a bomb placed under their car, another was shot at, and at least two others had been tortured. One of the group, speaking from hiding, told the BBC Tonight he was followed and attacked as a spy because of his links to the corporation. His words are spoken by one of our producers.
The last 18 months have been so stressful. We have regularly changed our house. My children have been to three different schools. Day by day, journalists and human rights activists are being followed by the Taliban authorities. They see the BBC as the enemy, some kind of spy agency.
British officials took more than a year to consider their cases and then ruled they weren't eligible because their work was not directly connected to government operations. Today, a judge said that was unlawful because ministers hadn't taken into account the wider risks the group faced because of their association with the BBC and the UK. Erin Alcock, their lawyer, said each of the eight had a clear and compelling case to be protected from Taliban reprisals.
When the British evacuated from Kabul, they were not put forward for evacuation by the BBC because they weren't currently employed by the BBC at that time. So they were left behind. The work that they were doing did go to British objectives in Afghanistan. Those objectives weren't just military objectives. They were things like promoting democracy.
The government hasn't yet responded to the decision, but ministers must now reconsider each case in the next 21 days.
Dominic Cassiani. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
They need to reduce their emissions and their carbon footprints. They need to make the moves and demonstrate that they're taking this seriously, because otherwise the sport won't continue. We have to protect what we've got before it's gone.
Calls for a complete overhaul of winter sports to make them more sustainable. For only the third time in the country's history, New Zealand has declared a state of emergency as Cyclone Gabrielle battered its North Island overnight. The Minister for Emergency Management, Kieran McAnulty, signed the declaration with tens of thousands of homes without power after heavy rain and strong winds. Freelance journalist Sarah Catherall has been following the story from Wellington, and just before recording this podcast, she described conditions there.
They're absolutely shocking. We've got reports of residents in Hawke's Bay on their roofs trying to escape rising floodwaters, and river banks have burst. There's an apartment block in Auckland that was evacuated as well because a tower was almost threatening to topple. There have been flights cancelled, ferries cancelled, and also a firefighter is currently missing after a landslide out in West Auckland. So it's pretty shocking. We've not seen anything like this.
And no sign of any respite for the affected area?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there are six particular regions. If you think of the North Island of New Zealand, particularly out on the east coast, Hawke's Bay and Tarawhiti and Bay of Plenty, Waikato, they're all really badly affected, heavily affected. They are still expecting rain coming and going over the next few days, but I think Wednesday there might be a glimmer of sunshine for Hawke's Bay, but floodwaters are so high that there's no respite.
Briefly, it's quite a thing, only the third time for a state of emergency.
Absolutely. That means that they can send all the other rescue teams to those affected areas, and that's a chance for those areas. I mean, I'm in Wellington and it's raining and stormy here as well, but we're not one of the ones that's particularly affected. So our crew will also go to those affected areas and help where needed.
Freelance journalist Sarah Catherall speaking to me from Wellington. One of Cambodia's last independent media outlets has been shut down just months before national elections. The Prime Minister, Hun Sen, who's among the world's longest-serving leaders, ordered the closure of online Khmer and English-language outlet Voice of Democracy because of what he said was an erroneous report about his eldest son. Sartut Luth is the media director of the organisation that ran the news site, the Cambodian Centre for Independent Media.
We were surprised because we did not expect that. We have tried our best to deal with this. We hope that it's not the end yet. So we are still trying to work with all relevant stakeholders, especially maybe we will try to reach out to the government, hopefully that they can allow VOD to continue its operation to commit on its mission to provide credible and reliable news to Cambodian people.
Phil Robertson is based in Bangkok and is the deputy director of the Asia division of Human Rights Watch. He told Paul Henley more about the work that the Voice of Democracy did.
This is a website that has continually exposed corruption and abuses by the government. It has also played a leading role in exposing the human trafficking cyber scams that have really been all the news both in Cambodia and around the region. And it's not welcome, especially as the government is moving towards the national election, when the government traditionally tries to censor any sort of critical voices. So they've figured out a really sort of ludicrous excuse to shut it down.
Sartut from the organization said he was hopeful the decision could be reversed. Will it?
Well, we're very hopeful that he can make some progress, but I'm not terribly optimistic given the track record of the government. Hun Sen rejected their offer of apology. I mean, these guys were quoting a government spokesperson about Hun Sen's son. And instead of penalizing the spokesperson, who obviously gave an erroneous report, Hun Sen went after the website.
Can you just describe what Voice of Democracy did and what kind of a hole it could leave in Cambodia's media landscape?
This was really the last independent media outlet operating in Cambodia, both in Khmer and English. They were doing investigative journalism. You know, they were reporting on abuses against workers and unions. They were looking at issues of land seizures by elites and cronies of the government. They were talking about certainly these cyber scam human trafficking centers, which have been defrauding people all over North America, Europe, and in the Asia Pacific region. You know, they were really the last effective independent media outlet that was really going to the ground and reflecting voices of people who have faced rights abuses and repression at the hands of the government.
Phil Robertson, the Deputy Director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. An opera house in the German city of Hanover has suspended its chief choreographer for allegedly throwing dog feces in the face of a prominent ballet critic. Police are investigating the attack, which happened while there was a full audience in the house. From Berlin, here's Damian McGuinness.
Wiebke Hüster of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung was not exactly impressed by Marco Goerke's latest experimental ballet. Death by boredom was her verdict. But it seems that Mr. Goerke, who until today was the chief choreographer at Hanover State Theatre, finds criticism difficult to deal with. During the interval of a performance at the theatre on Saturday, the same day that the review was published, the critic was confronted by the outraged choreographer. He threatened to ban her from the theatre and said that people had cancelled their season tickets because of her piece. He then produced a bag of dog excrement, which he smeared over her face. The theatre's director has apologised to Ms. Hüster and suspended the award-winning choreographer, who is now banned from entering the building. The newspaper Ms. Hüster writes for said this attack showed how some high-ranking artists felt themselves above criticism, even resorting to violence, describing it as a deliberate attempt to humiliate and intimidate the press.
Damian McGuinness. In an open letter to the International Ski Federation, a group of athletes is calling for dramatic changes to winter sport, saying current sustainability efforts are insufficient and that skiing is becoming increasingly difficult to justify as the effects of climate change worsen. They want to explore moving the competitions later in the season. Shemi Alcott is a four-time Winter Olympic British skier and presents a skiing programme on the BBC called Ski Sunday. Evan Davis asked her if the main thing at issue is that a lack of snow means it has to be flown in.
Yeah, we've seen a massive reduction in the amount of snowfall that we've had over the last few years. I mean, this Christmas was pretty disastrous. You see helicopters left, right and centre coming over and bringing snow to kind of patch the hill. And when we started Ski Sunday this season, we were in Adelboden and there was literally a strip of snow down the middle and everything was grass to the left and the right of it. So they're having to make crazy decisions, not for the good of the future of our winters, just to keep these events sustainable.
What is the solution? Because you really want to go to places when they have their peak actual snow rather than going to places where they then have to create the snow or fly it in.
I think FIS really need to look hard at their calendar. This winter, the tour has flipped back and forth from America to Europe. And then after the World Championships here in France, the men fly back to California, which is crazy and unnecessary. They also need to look at the volume of events and the fact that the athletes now have less access to pre-season training because of the reduction in the glaciers in the summer. So less training obviously means far more injuries in our sports. I guess they are the figureheads of ski racing. Mm. They need to reduce their emissions and their carbon footprint. And they're such a huge part of it that they need to make the moves and demonstrate that they're taking this seriously, because otherwise the sport won't continue. We have to protect what we've got before it's gone.
That's really relating to the professionals. As the hobby, where does it go? Because it does feel as though there's been a very appreciable change in snow levels, in certainly in the Alps in Europe in the last 5 years.
Yeah, and we definitely need to start making more sustainable choices. And those are out there. We can choose travelling by train over plane. That reduces the CO2. This winter, actually, I have driven over 6,500 kilometres in my electric car. I've got so much kit, so the train isn't an option. So I'm testing that format out. It's been absolutely brutal at times, but I want to pat myself on the back for trying it in these early stages of electric cars. You've got to choose resorts that are powered by renewable energy. So Anzair in Switzerland, also Le Chevalier in France, even St. Anton in Austria, it's really making all the right moves. You can rent your kit instead of buying it. I rent all my ski clothing for the winter from Eco Ski. You can eat locally, produce food. It was crazy for me yesterday.
Yeah, but it's still skiing. It's a very high impact, environmental impact thing, isn't it? I mean, it is, particularly if the snow isn't there and you have to create it.
Yeah, but the snow isn't there because of the decisions that we've all been making. It's been kind of a flippancy that these winters will always be here. And we need to act now and protect our winters, which was the umbrella that this letter was written through. Yeah. It's a climate action group. And I just think it's important to say that this isn't just about skiing holidays. Our mountains play an integral part in keeping our planet cool. So even if you don't love the snow, we've got to do all we can to protect it.
Shemi Alcott speaking to Evan Davis. The Czech Republic international Jakub Jankto has become the most high-profile current male footballer to come out as gay. The 27-year-old, who's on loan at Sparta Prague from the Spanish side Getafe, has played 45 times for his country. Nigel Adderley has more details.
Only a handful of male footballers have chosen to come out as gay. And of that small group, many have chosen to reveal the fact only after their playing careers were over. This is a sharp contrast to the women's game, where a number of international stars have felt comfortable in revealing their sexuality. Jakub Jankto is the first current international footballer to speak out in the male side of the sport, and took to Twitter in an emotional statement.
Like everybody else, I have my strengths. I have my weaknesses. I have a family. I have my friends. Like everybody else, I also want to live my life in freedom, without fears, without prejudice, without violence, but with love. I'm homosexual, and I no longer want to hide myself.
Jankto's club, Sparta Prague, have said he discussed his sexuality with the management and players some time ago, and they have said nothing else matters, go live your life. His revelation has also been supported by football's world governing body FIFA and a number of clubs and fellow players. Former Germany midfielder Thomas Hitzlsperger, who came out in 2014, a few months after retiring, tweeted, "What a player, what a personality. Well done, Jakob, for speaking up and leading the way for others."
Nigel Adderley. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.